We're talking about hunting and fishing tonight, so, right? It is kind of interesting, all of the different work that they had to do just to stay alive, and gathering and agriculture becoming such an important aspect of their life that the scriptures are full of practical examples that they would have been dealing with on a daily basis. And I think that's just so neat. So tonight we're talking about hunting. Can you think of any hunters in the Bible?
Esau.
Okay. Nimrod was a mighty hunter. There are not a lot of them that would come to mind, is there? There's one more that I think of as David. It wasn't so much that he was going out for the sport of it or trying to hunt for the sake of bringing in game, but it was part of a shepherd's job in protecting his sheep and providing a safe environment for his sheep to go out and to kill those wild beasts. And on two occasions, he had close encounters. They came after his sheep, and he was not going to let them do that. So, though we don't have a lot of references to hunters, there are still quite a few references to hunting. And we'll pick up a few of those this evening. As we think of Israel today, it's probably not our go-to hunting location. Most of it we think of as kind of barren land. What isn't barren is agricultural and war-torn areas. But there was a point in time before God's curse on Israel had really taken effect and brought drought and barrenness to the land, before wars and things have decimated the land, before the population of the area got so high that it would have used up the wild animals and so forth, there was a period of time when wildlife would have been plentiful. Exodus 23 and verse 29. Okay, so there was a danger that the wildlife would take over, especially thinking of dangerous animals, things like lions and bears and leopards and things like that would have become a problem, and even cutting down on their population because they would become manhunters. The Jordan Valley is the main source of a lot of the wildlife in Israel. And it's a very, they call it a rift. It's like a tear in the earth. And so it's very steep, very rugged. Not a lot of people are going to be traveling through that kind of territory. At least, you know, if they did, they'd stick to the path. They're not going to be going up and down the mountainsides, whereas animals, God has made wonderfully for their environment. And so, you know, it just amazes me. You go out to the Rocky Mountains or the Black Hills and you see these mountain goats, and they're just up on the craggiest places you'd never be able to get to. You know, it'll be on a slope of loose stones and stuff that would just, you know, shift and move under our weight, but they're just kind of go right up those mountainsides. And so animals will live where people won't go, and so they would live there in this region of the Jordan Rift, and yet every year the Jordan Valley would flood. And so the lowlands, where there was all kinds of undergrowth, where a lot of the animals would be hiding in, would get flooded, and those wild animals would come up out of the rift, and that's when they became a problem. And the lions and things would come out and start prowling around, looking for new territory, And the flood would end, and they would all end up going back into their habitat again. Jeremiah 49 and verse 19. Okay, the floodplain of the Jordan, does anybody else have a different translation of that? Okay. There's a, what's that? No, the place. Okay, there's the waters of Merom, or what is called today Lake Hula, is actually north of the Sea of Galilee. And it was a slough, a swampy area, and it was known for a lot of animals being up in that area, but especially lions. And now Israel has, and modern man has gone in and drained the land, and so it's not like it was during Bible times, but there's still a lake there, and the area around it you can see is all green because of the agriculture. You could tell that they have pivots and things to irrigate, and so the land has changed a little bit, but there were places, isolated places throughout the land that would have been very good for hunting. There would have been a lot of waterfowl in that area, whereas most of Israel wouldn't have been conducive to waterfowl. Well, how do you hunt if you don't have a gun? You don't have a gun, you have to get close to your prey, and that's tricky. It's a real challenge even today with a gun to hunt a deer sometimes, but as you have to use a bow, you've got to take a lot of extra precautions. You got to make sure your scent is covered, the wind's in favor, you're in a tree, and so forth. It just takes a lot of extra work to get that close to the animal. And so it's not very productive if you're trying to hunt for a large population of people. You need to be able to get your game quickly, or enough of that game to supply the need in a timely way. And so if you were rich, or if you were a king, you had the benefit of horses. And it was a sport. They would go out on their horses and do hunts. And a lot of those hunts were not so much for the bringing in of food, but keeping the wild animal population down. So you'd have a pride of lions out there, they're starting to cause problems. The king would issue a hunt, and it would be an opportunity for the king and his men to show their bravery and their muscular manhood. But they would go out with their horses, or maybe horses and chariots, and hunt. But you see, this is up close and personal. That's a little too close for me, and it's kind of hard to see in that picture, but his hand there is holding a sword that is going through the belly of the lion, and I think his other hand might be grabbing at his neck or his beard. And I think I'd let somebody else take that. They would use their spears, their bows and arrows, and hunt them from a chariot or from a horse or something, but sometimes things got a little bit close. They have, amazingly, a lot of pictures or carvings and things that they're finding in archaeology of depictions of hunts. Well, I don't find that all that surprising. I mean, you ever come across a hunter that didn't want to tell his story? And you come across this kind of a hunt, and that's, your claim to fame. You had the bravery enough to take on a lion or something. You're going to try to record that for further generations. But here's one up here. He's riding his horse, and he's chasing two different kinds of deer. One looks a little bit more like a gazelle or something with the two single horns, and then the other one has more of what we think of an antlers, where it has divisions on the antler. There are a number of animals recorded in Scripture. I think of, I didn't put it in here, but when you look at the animals that were necessary for Solomon's table when he was a king, they list three or four different deer-like creatures in that list. And so somebody had to be out there hunting in order to bring those in. So you're not a king. You don't have a horse. How are you going to do it? Well, oftentimes they would dig pits, and then they would put up brush and different things to create an approach to their pit so that they would kind of direct the animal so that it would go to the pit. And then they would try to spook it and herd it and drive it in that way. Let's look at 1 Chronicles 11:22. Normally, when they get the creature in the pit, they would just stand above and shoot their bow down into the pit. You wonder, what was the occasion? I just think of that story. I can never remember both of the guys. Joab and the other commander came together at the well, and they get to joshing back and forth, and they suggest, well, let's have our men fight and just see, you know, have this competition and see who's got the best men. I can kind of see that going on in a situation like this. Here we got a lion down in the pit. I just bet you he wouldn't go down in there and kill that lion. Oh yeah? I bet he would. And he goes down in there and proves his bravery in killing the lion. They would have used a number of different types of trap, not necessarily just the pit. Job 18, verses 8 through 10. Okay, so there's several different kinds of traps there. Some of them involve a net. Some of them are snare-like traps. But Israel, the Israelites had to be careful about that because they weren't allowed to eat things that were found dead or had been strangled. And so if you have a snare, you've got to make sure you know what you're doing to keep that snare from completely killing the animal before its time. But those were common things in the region where, you know, the Gentiles wouldn't have been held to that. Job 41 and verse 28 and 29 also show us a number of different weapons that were often used. Okay, I think there's four different ones listed there. Here's our picture. Demonstrates the way that they may have used some nets. This is actually out of medieval times, but they're actually putting to use ancient methods. They would have gaps in hedgerows or something that they would put a net, and as the animal went through, you can see that it's still tied and it holds him, and they would come up and kill the animal. Other times you have a trap-like thing that casts the net over them, or they get tangled up in the net, and then you're able to come along, and that there would be a wild boar, another animal you don't want to get too close to. At least, you know, it'd be nice that he's caught fast before you try to get that close. And so some of those nets stretched out across an open area that you're driving the animal through and it gets itself caught into a net. Nets especially were used for trapping birds. And Scripture talks about the nets of the fowler. One of the aspects of the fowling net is that they would set the trap in such a way that there was a bait, something that the birds would come to, and then they'd be able to either cast the net over them, or the trap was set in such a way as it would go off and throw a net or something over the birds. Proverbs 6 and verse 5. Okay, Proverbs 7 and verse 24. Maybe I was typing quickly. Proverbs 29 and verse 6. Okay. So sin is pictured as a snare, and it grasps us, it holds us fast, and ultimately it brings us to death. Just as these pictures show, these animals may have been going about their business, got themselves, their antlers caught in one of these nets, and they're held there until the hunter can come along and take its life. Jeremiah 48, 43, and 44. So it demonstrates there that maybe they used multiple methods at the same time. That snare may be set in one part of the path and a pit dug in a more appropriate place. And he manages to escape the one, he gets caught in the other. It is kind of frustrating as a trapper. You set the snare and you have to wait, and time passes, and finally something got in your snare, but you come to check it and your snare's gone. Something broke the snare and escaped. I think Sam had one this year that he ended up catching twice. Exodus 34 and verse 12. Okay, again a warning, but just kind of interesting as we went out Thanksgiving time, and we set all kinds of traps and snares and different things, and the kids thought, well, we'll really catch a lot here in the next couple of days, but really they didn't. But Sam left those snares and traps in place, and it took a month and a half for some of them before they became active. But that snare was waiting, just sitting there. And that's what they're saying here. You leave these people in the land, it's like a time bomb. It's just waiting to capture you. It's going to snare you at some point in time. And Sam said he had every path, every entrance and exit off of Mom and Dad's property with snares and things, and just nothing was happening until one day he ended up catching, I think he said, five different coyote all at the same time. In the same day. And it's a patient game. He was waiting. He knew the day would come. Ezekiel 19, verses 3 and 4. Okay, so there's a ruler that is being likened to a man-eating lion, but that he was trapped and how did that end? Was it hooks or nets or something? Chained? Chained, okay. You know, we think of Daniel in the lion's den. How would you like to be the guy that provided the lions? Talk about somebody that was brave to be able to go out and to capture lions alive and to bring them to the lion's den. I'm sure I'd want chains too, and not just some rope or something. I'm going to make sure he's not going to get loose on me. Take vengeance. Fishing. Though fishing was known in Egypt on an industrial scale, it doesn't seem to have really taken hold until many years later. By the time of Christ, of course, it was a real industry. But we see in that Old Testament period, it doesn't seem to be a major thing. Of course, if you think about it, when they first came into the land, there's plenty of game and wildlife, but as the human population grows, that game becomes scarce. You've either killed it or scared it off. And so you now have to turn to other things. And fishing is one of those sources that are plentiful. They had, of course, the Mediterranean Sea there, but they also had the Sea of Galilee. And that became a very significant industry hub. You know, the Jewish people were not really known for their boats. A lot of times we read, it talks about shipping and things, but it's usually somebody else is doing it. And I think there was one example where the king of Israel put together a fleet and a storm came and destroyed it. And so, you know, it's not that Israel was known for its navy. And yet boats would have been a part of their life. In Egypt, they would have had these reed-type boats. Egypt, there's a plenty of reeds, and it is amazing what they're able to do with that stuff. I thought I knew about these, big enough for maybe a couple of people, but I got to looking online, and they have regular, almost ship-size boats that are just made out of reeds. It's amazing. They even craft the front end came up, and then they crafted the reeds into like a figurehead of an animal or something. It just really some nice craftsmanship. Fishing with the hook may have provided for small populations or for sport. There are excavations at Gezer actually found a fish hook. Amos chapter 4 and verse 2. Not an appealing situation. Never forget that family vacation when Sam was kind of rebellious. We're trying to keep him close, and he kept running ahead, trying to explore the shoreline, and he stumbled and ran a fish hook right up through his thumb. And a trip to the emergency room and try to dig that out. It's very painful. And when you're snagged, you're snagged. Spear fishing would have been an Egyptian method. They have artwork that demonstrates them doing that. And one of the methods, other than just doing it in the shallows, where the fish will come up by your feet and you spear them, maybe a little bit more effective, they would go out in their boat at night and they'd hang a lantern out over the edge of the boat, and the fish would be drawn to that light to come up and see what it is. And as they would come up, they'd spear them and plop them in the boat, and they'd be able to get more fish that way. Yeah, we have so many laws these days. You know, they take all the fun and exploration out of the thing, but that sound like could be a lot of fun doing it that way. Job 41 and verse 7. Okay, they used harpoons and fishing spears, different things that in that case they could not, they didn't work on Leviathan. He was too big, too strong. This is interesting. Matthew chapter 17 and verse 27, one of the situations are using a line and hook.
And for me and you.
They call it the St. Peter fish today. It's the tilapia. And the tilapia, the pictures I've seen, they look about like a crappie, maybe just a little bit fatter. Some of them they catch would be bluegill size, large bluegill. But they're a very plentiful fish, especially in the Sea of Galilee. But it is interesting that the tilapia will hold the eggs in their mouth until they hatch. And even after they hatch, the little fry will hide in mom's mouth. And so sometimes she's got to eat, right? So she's not going to just swallow her kids. She's got to shoo the young ones out of her mouth, go and find something to eat, and then those young ones quickly find their way back in, and they want to hide there. It's a safe place. Well, those little fry are growing, and there's a point in time mom doesn't want to carry her fish around in her mouth all the time. And so she goes and finds something to hold in her mouth. And then the little fish come and they don't like it and they stay out of her mouth. And of course, fish are drawn to anything shiny. We use shiny lures and things to attract their attention. And so they would pick up a coin or something in that case. I just thought that was very interesting. I never had heard that before. They'd use different nets. The casting net. I bought one of these just out of curiosity. And my kids ran off with it. They would be 8 to 15 feet in diameter. And it takes some practice in order to make it work. You have to hold the net in just kind of a particular way and spread it out. It's got weights along the outside edge, and then on mine, there were cords that went from the outside edge up through a center hole. So when you pulled on it, it would suck the outside edge up and make a basket. And so you'd spread it all out, and you hold it just right, and you'd get your whole body to swing, and you try to spin that out so that it opens up completely before it hits the water. And so the weights would take it down, and then you'd drag it in, and you'd have to sort out the fish. You'd catch small stuff that wouldn't be worth keeping, bigger stuff you'd want to keep. Mark 1 in verse 16 and 17. Okay, so that is the activity that they were engaged in when Jesus called his disciples. They were fishermen, and they employed many different methods. And we'll see that in different places, they used different nets and things. And so, you know, Peter knew how to fish with a hook and line. That wouldn't have been the most effective way. A net could be used from shore or in the shallows, and it could be used right from the boat. And they say that on the Sea of Galilee, sometimes the shore is in such a relationship to the water that the people on shore can tell where there's a pod of fish sometimes when somebody out in the boat can't. And so that brings into mind Jesus telling them to cast the net on the other side of the boat. Of course, I'm sure they had already cast. They'd been fishing all night. They knew what they were doing, and yet it's like, you want me to do it again? I'll do it again. And they submitted to that. There was the dragnet. The dragnet was a rectangular net, 8 feet tall, and sometimes it could be hundreds of feet long. And it was used in a number of different ways. Sometimes they would take it out in the boat and they would drop it off as they were moving the boat along. The top of the net would have a rope in it that had cork. The bottom of the net had a rope in it that had lead weights. So that would stretch that out down through the water. And they would draw their boat around in a circle and come back to where they started. And then they'd start pulling that net in. And they would be sure to pull tight the bottom rope first. And it would kind of make a basket out of the net that would entrap the fish. Sometimes they would take it in, maybe you'd only have one boat instead of two. And so the person would take it and he'd go out and he'd sweep back to shore. And then helpers on shore would drag that in. And when you did that, you're coming up into the shallows. And so you'd get a lot of debris and stuff because it's working anything off the bottom of the lake. So sometimes they would run that out, and then somebody would go along just outside of the range of the net and start throwing rocks in the water and spook fish in the direction of the net, and then they would encircle the net and draw it in, trying to maximize the number of their take. Habakkuk 1 and verse 13 through 17. Habakkuk's got a complaint against God. Why should you treat everybody this way? Doesn't seem right. And he begins by saying, you know, you're hooking them with a hook, but he doesn't stop there. And I think it's because, you know, in part, there's a certain personal responsibility in that. The fish that gets caught on the hook responded to the bait. But the fish that gets caught in the net, it was indiscriminate. You draw that net in, you catch everything that was in that area, and you drag it up on shore, and then the fishermen had to sit there and sort it. This is a good fish to eat, this is not a good fish to eat. This one's too big, this one's too small. This is, you know, some other creature that got caught in the net. And there's this piece of debris, and he's got to go through his net and clean his net out. It just took everything. And that's what Habakkuk is saying, is you use this net and you've just indiscriminately captured all of mankind, and the good as well as the bad, and you're using this wicked king to do this. And he felt it very unjust. John 21 and verse 11. Okay, so this is that dragnet. They had been using it between two boats, and there was such a catch of fish that it was going to break the net. They couldn't get it up into the boat, and so they worked it to shore, and Peter bailed on him, right? When he knew it was Jesus, he threw his clothes on, jumped in the water, and went to see Jesus. But when the other guys kind of caught up and they got everything to shore, Peter jumps up, he runs over there, grabs this massive net, and drags the whole thing up on shore himself. Peter was, he was strong. He was a real hefty fellow. We can understand, even in that context, you know, having to put his clothes on. Anytime you're working with nets like that, you're constantly dragging water up on you, and you'd just be soaked through. And so they'd set their outer garments aside and work, and then when the work was done, they'd air dry and throw their clothes back on. Matthew 13, 47 through 48. Okay. That's the reality. There's many of the parables that Christ taught of that end time, when Christ returns, there's going to be a separation of the good and the evil. And so he uses this aspect of an indiscriminate net that catches everything, and then the sorting that takes place. Nobody's going to escape it. There's a Sea of Galilee boat. They designed after some things they found in the lake bed to show what those boats were like. I think, if I remember studying this before, they didn't think that the Sea of Galilee used boats large enough to house 13 people. So it was kind of like, you know, it's just a fancy story. But they knew about most of their boats would have been a 2 or 3 person boat that they would do their fishing out of. But then they found this, and it's plenty big.